all about delivering care when and where the patient needs it.
The sooner we can get high-level critical care to the patient, the better off the patient's going to be.
This is certainly a costly intervention.
I think this is a great move for emergency medicine. It's what we're all about.
Throughput has become a real problem.
This is totally logical.
This is a complex topic.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, joined by my co-host, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Gentlemen, how are you doing this podcast?
Doing great, Mike. Good evening.
Likewise, doing very well, Mike.
Yep, always a pleasure to be here with you guys.
Well, we are very excited about this particular podcast. It's certainly been something that we've been receiving several emails on in light of a recent paper that was just published in JAMA Network Open regarding ED-based ICUs. And this particular study, as we'll talk about, we're going to do a deep dive in the paper shortly. Lead author was Kyle Gunnarsson, and it's in essence a paper looking at some before and after metrics of the implementation of their ED-based ICU within the ED at the University of Michigan. So we'll get into a little bit more specifics, but in terms of the background, John, absolutely, probably forms the premise of the podcast here on CCPEM, talking about caring for the critically ill patient in the ED, in the ICU, sometimes in resource-limited settings. It's all about delivering care when and where the patient needs it. So provide us with a little bit of background, John, on these ED-based ICUs.
No, absolutely, Mike. And I think over the past 10 years, there's been a lot of literature that's been published and a lot of well-known emergency medicine researchers, including people like Steve Treziak and a number of other well-known EM physician scientists, have looked at the impact of strain, and particularly hospital strain, on throughput in the emergency department. And I think all of us got into emergency medicine really loving the critically ill patients that come in through our ED. We feel that we can have a very high impact on those patients. But with the nature of the emergency department, there are a number of patients that also come through. We have high volumes, and throughput has become a real problem, particularly for critically ill patients, as our inpatient ICUs have gotten to near capacity levels on a daily basis. So critical illness in general and injuries account for about 40% of the total annual U.S. hospital costs. So it's a fairly significant amount of the $260 billion in annual hospital costs presents the U.S. each year. And many healthcare systems, again, they face this increased acuity. So we know that the number of critically ill patients has gone up annually over the past decade. And as I mentioned before, the decreased ICU availability, and in particular, the national shortage of not only physicians, but ICU physicians. And this has placed a greater demand to deliver critical care, not in the traditional ICU, but outside the ICU. And this is focused in particular in the emergency department. It's estimated that the total annual hours of critical care delivered in U.S. emergency departments has increased by an astounding number, by more than 200%. Particularly within 2001 to 2009 in a previous study. So not only are we feeling this increased strain, but we're delivering more hours of critical care downstairs. There are a number of studies that particularly have looked at. We mentioned a little bit about the impact of strain. So boarding times in particular, I think we are all keen on that 6-hour mark as being a cutoff for ICU boarders and where it starts to impact patient outcomes. And in response to all of this, some healthcare systems, a few across the country, have started rethinking how can we approach this problem. And one potential solution, maybe we need to set up more focused critical care areas within our walls, within the emergency department. And ED-based ICUs may be an option for some institutions to deliver earlier critical care. So this paper focuses on Michigan's experience and their development of their emergency critical care center that they call their EC3. And this paper is an interesting look into their process and outcomes and their resource use within the hospital itself after the implementation of their EC3. So with that kind of framing the paper, Rob, maybe you could go through the study methods and kind of how they did this research article and presented it.
Thanks, John. So this was a before and after retrospective study, cohort analysis from this Center at University of Michigan, and their objective was to examine patient outcomes and resource use before and after implementation of their EC3. Their center is an academic medical center with approximately 75,000 ED visits per year. And in their ED, they have 5 resuscitation rooms and trauma bays. And they set up this EC3, which consisted of 9 rooms, sort of EDICU rooms, that were notably located adjacent to the ED. And this EC3 was staffed by EM physicians with or without specific critical care training. And that included EM residents, fellows, physician assistants who had critical care training, ED nurses with ICU training, RTs, and pharmacists. And notably, the patient-to-nurse ratio in this EC3 was 2-to-1, sort of almost typical of what you would see in an ICU. In terms of workflow in this EC3, all the ED patients were initially evaluated and treated by the main ED team. And in the before cohort, before the EC3 cohort, patients would remain in their ED rooms until an ICU bed became available. In the after EC3 cohort, patients could be transferred for care by the EC3 team and taken care of in the 9-bed EDICU. And some of the common indications for being cared for in this EC3 unit were severe sepsis, septic shock, altered mental status, overdose, major electrolyte imbalance, DKA, GI bleed, respiratory distress, CHF, and undifferentiated shock or hypotension. So sort of your typical ICU type patients. And the pre-EC3 cohort consisted of all visits to the ED from September 2012 to February 2015. And then the post-EC3 cohort after implementation of the EC3 was all visits to the ED from February of 2015 to the end of July 2017. Their primary mortality outcome was 30-day mortality among all ED patients before and after the EC3. And their other primary ICU outcome was ICU admission rates before and after the implementation of the EC3. So, Peter, why don't you take us through the results of this study?
Yeah, Rob, so the results are pretty astounding. So if we think about it, the patients who were enrolled, just under 350,000 encounters during the period. In the two cohorts, the pre-EC3 cohort had 168,000 and the post-EC3 cohort had 180,000 patients. So pretty fair close numbers. The mean daily census of the EC3 was 6.9 patients treated by the EC3 clinicians and 4.1 patients as overflow from the main ED treated by the main ED clinicians. So the mean time in the ED until transfer to the EC3 was just over 3.5 hours at 3.7 hours. And the mean EC3 length of stay was 9.4 hours. So that gives you a time frame for when they were there. When we look at the mortality, which is, you know, the big take-home point, the 30-day mortality rate among all ED patients really was no difference. When they broke it down to the multivariate analysis, demonstrated a transition to EC3 was associated with a 15-point reduction in the odds of 30-day mortality. So we restrict it to only the patients with an ECI 1 or 2, the EC3 was associated with a significant reduction in odds of 30-day mortality. So if we're talking about the sicker patients, they get a bigger bang for the buck. The observed reduction in risk-adjusted 30-day mortality for 73,000 patients per year in their ED equates to 220 lives saved per year after the implementation of the emergency critical care center, their EC3. When we talk about ICU admissions, the unadjusted rate of ED admissions to the ICU per 100,000 ED visits actually decreased with the implementation of the EC3 by just about 13%. Now, post-EC3 cohort was associated with a significant reduction in the odds of short-stay ICU admissions, so length of stay less than 24 hours. So I'd like to hear what you guys have to think about those results.
Well, outstanding discussion, Rob and Peter, in terms of the review of the study itself and then the results. And I think it's certainly something that has been discussed for a few years now, the ED-ICU-based model. And as you've heard across the country, there's a few different models, and we'll get to that in a moment. But this is really the first paper analyzing and publishing outcomes from one center's experience. And Peter, just to reemphasize what you said in terms of their risk-adjusted mortality, so in their multivariate analysis, there was a 15.4% reduction in the odds of 30-day mortality. And a decreased rate of ED admissions to the ICU by about 13%. So fairly significant. And the authors go over this in their discussion as to the potential reasonings for a mortality reduction for decreased ICU resource utilization, or therefore optimization of ICU resources. And with respect to the mortality, they certainly say it requires a deeper dive, more in-depth analysis, but they do highlight the fact that many of these patients were receiving critical care or ICU level care much earlier in their disease presentation as their prior model, where they would get resuscitated and simply wait to be transferred upstairs to the ICU. And in terms of the ICU resource optimization, Rob, what you had said for the conditions, many of the conditions that go to EC3, a fair percentage of those turn out to be short stay ICU admissions. And you can see that many of these conditions, these short stay ICU admissions, were efficiently and effectively taken care of by EC3 such that they could be downgraded and subsequently admitted to non-ICU levels of care. Therefore, it provides the inpatient ICU better resource utilization for patients who are crashing on the floor or those inter-hospital transfer patients with time-critical or time-sensitive illness. So I'm sure more debate will come on why they saw mortality reductions and more efficient ICU admissions. But John, I want to turn to you because you have a very unique perspective on this. And in essence, you have a similar unit at University of Pennsylvania. So I want to turn things over to you for a few minutes and kind of go through your experience, what your unit looks like, the model, and if you have any data to report on your outcomes.
Yeah, Mike, so thanks. So we did, in fact, construct something similar to the model that Michigan kind of reports and is utilizing there. It's a focus, smaller space. I think if we matched our hospitals, they're fairly similar in terms of patient population, as well as number of ED presentations. We're also in the downtown campus, seeing about 80,000 patients per year with a pretty significant ICU cohort. So on average, about 10% of our admissions traditionally would go on to ICU admission. And with the similarly constructed space where there was focused clinical care in a fixed bed model, where nursing ratios, which to be honest are probably one of the most important staffing strategies that you can use that's evidence-based to impact outcomes, reducing your nursing ratios for sick patients. At the end of the day, it's increasing the number of eyes and hands available to the patients that need it most. And as we look at our data and we're analyzing some of our outcomes, we've published one paper looking at DKA, the impact on DKA, and I think that's one of those short, quick turnaround patients that oftentimes you can make non-critically ill relatively quickly. But we're currently looking at our data for other cohorts, including sepsis and acute respiratory failure. And I think one of the common themes that's coming out of this is with rapid, prompt attention and resuscitation and early critical care, you can have a significant impact on the need for inpatient ICU stay. So historically, as month by month, we were reducing the number of ICU admissions or downgrading the number of ICU patients prospectively by about 30 to 40% than if we use the historical control. And we're in the midst of looking at now our three-year data to see if we can replicate, or at least it shows it's a replication study of what was done at Michigan. And I have a good sense that that will likely be true based off of my experience and with talking with the lead author here, Kyle, we have pretty similar outcomes. So I think from a clinical care standpoint, this is a great paper to show what we're capable of doing with a little bit of restructuring. But this is a complex topic, and it's good to have you guys on the podcast as well, because everyone has some different perspectives, whether it's from the administrative side, leadership side too, because there's a lot more to developing a space like this in addition to just the clinical care. There's the resources that are required to maintain it from the department side, from the hospital side. And this is certainly a costly intervention and something that has to be taken into account, particularly as payments for critical illness are changing significantly, both recently and in the near future. So that's my take. I think it's a great resource. It provides a lot of value, I think, to the patients, but certainly something that needs to be supported from the hospital side. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Peter, I'm interested, you know, you're in the ICU as well as the ED, and you're, for many people who may not know, you're also really at the C-suite level. So looking across your system, what are your thoughts on this resource?
So I like this resource in the ED if we can have quick hit turnaround. So both of the things make plenty of sense, which is the sooner we can get high-level critical care to the patient, the better off the patient's going to be. Anytime we can streamline throughput within the hospital, that's a major win. And so you're going to see the C-suite jump at anything that's going to stream through, be ED throughput, just plain hospital throughput, because people are coming into the ICU, both from the ED as well as from the OR, as well as from the floor, rapid responses and that kind of thing. So if you can decrease that burden and give them more time to work on those more chronic ICU level patients, I think that's best. I think the struggle will still be deciding who you keep in the ED and who you move on. And again, it's pretty simple to say that DKA is a no-brainer, but when we start talking about septic patients with comorbidities, it's a little bit tougher decision. But again, from the C-suite standpoint, as well as a critical care standpoint, I think we're going to see an increase in this move.
And Rob, what about your experience at UCSF?
Yeah, so I have to say that I have limited experience with this. It's just as Peter and all of you really mentioned, it's kind of an administrative issue. Our ED at San Francisco General, there's really a big push to get patients straight up to the ICU. We always have a huge backlog of ward beds and med-surg beds, backlog of patients waiting for that. But we, in general, have pretty wide open beds in the ICU. And so therefore, we typically can get patients to the ICU pretty quickly. And there's not been much of a demand for a unit like this. Having said all that, this is totally logical. This completely makes sense. I am a big proponent of more ED care for ICU patients, especially selected patients, as Peter mentioned, like DKAs and some overdoses and other cases that can have a quick transition. I think this is a great move for emergency medicine. It's what we're all about, and I fully support this type of endeavor.
Well, gentlemen, this has been an outstanding discussion. Our congrats to Dr. Gunnarsson and his colleagues at the University of Michigan for really a great paper, really leading the way in terms of getting this out first to publish outcomes on mortality along with resource utilization for ICU resource utilization in these ED-based ICUs. If any of you have any questions, I'm sure many of you will as a result of reviewing this particular paper and thinking about implementation of this at your own institution. Please reach out to us via email through our website. I know many of the administrators who listen to this podcast will be thinking, well, what's the cost? What are the deeper dive? What are real nuts and bolts? And we have an expert with John here on the podcast who's already gone through it and done it. So please let us know if you have any questions or follow-up questions from this discussion. But gentlemen, my thanks. This has been really, really informative and certainly something that will be continued to be talked about in the years to come. Once again, this is going to close us out here for this podcast. Once again, this is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine for Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Looking forward to talking to you our next podcast. Bye for now.